Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Ed King, teaching English as a foreign language in Kazakhstan and China, and also spotting the Royal Marines popping up where they weren't supposed to be. Then David Saunders, Bristol Green activist, looking beyond Extinction Rebellion. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
My name's Ed King. I've been teaching in a mixture of Kazakhstan, China and Slovakia for the last 6 years. And, yeah, Kazakhstan has changed a lot during the last 6 years.
So having finished your education in the UK, what made you decide to take off, you know, halfway around the world?
A mixture of things. I had the opportunity, I had the qualifications, and I mean, I wanted to set up abroad because I don't see a very bright future for the UK. So I've decided just to kind of start working abroad and getting used to it that way.
Well, there's a lot of young people who think the same, that the opportunities aren't very good. In fact, you know, my generation will be telling your generation that actually we had a pretty good chance and opportunities to get employment. I mean, for example, people finishing their O-levels here in Bristol, if they had science O-levels, could pretty much walk it straight into an apprenticeship at Filton Engineering, that sort of thing. Now, those opportunities have gone. Do you think that's, you know, a normal thing for people of your age, pretty much to think, well, actually, my opportunities may well be elsewhere?
Yeah, but I think a lot of people struggle just to take the leap of faith and just jump right out there. So a lot of my friends, they still, like, they're not really progressing through their careers. They're all just kind of staying at the same level, and unfortunately, they're not really progressing anywhere. And they say they'd like to change or do something different, but they don't have opportunities, or they don't have education, or they're just too scared to jump out and leave family. And
but you say the opportunity arose to go abroad. How was that?
I wanted to go abroad just to do some travelling, because that was something my family had always said they'd love to do but didn't have much choice. And then I just did a one-month course, and then the same school offered me a job in Kazakhstan.
So what was that course?
It's called a TEFL course, so I did one called TESOL, which is Trinity. There's another company called Cambridge, and a third one called Oxford. And they will all offer a one-month course, some of them online now. And then you can just, as long as you've got a degree in that, sometimes not even a degree, you can get a job almost anywhere.
Okay, so one thing doing a TEFL course, but how did you end up with this job in Kazakhstan?
So the school I trained with, they funnily enough had a school in Kazakhstan as well. And it was just, they offered it as a starting point for
my
career.
Where is Kazakhstan?
So it borders Russia and China, the two main ones. So it's around there. So a lot of the testing during the Soviet Union was done in Kazakhstan, because it's a big steppe and lots of it's just, there's nothing around. So it's a good little
steppe?
Test.
What is the steppe?
Steppe's just a flat land with nothing there. So it goes from, yeah, northwest China through to Kazakhstan. There's just basically nothing but, like, flat.
How big is it?
It's pretty big. I couldn't tell you for certain because I haven't done it across, although there is a train that you can take across that some tourists tend to do.
Okay, so how old were you when you arrived there then?
21.
And how long did you stay?
So I did 2 years the first stint, and then I went back for half a year, but I had to leave again, unfortunately, because my master's work was getting too heavy with my full-time job there.
So you were trying to do a course in the UK, were you, whilst you were out in Kazakhstan?
For the second stint, yeah. So the first stint was just having fun, 21 years old, out in the world, in, yeah, a bit of a crazy place. So
what was it like living there? What differences between here and Kazakhstan then?
Definitely a lot more bleak out there. So you'll see, I guess a lot of people have seen some of Europe a bit more now, so like Slovakia and ex-USSR places tend to be a bit more colourful. But it was a very grey place. And
weather?
Weather was mixed. Cold in the winter, snow very high. Some beautiful nature out there, to be fair. Like beautiful mountains, lakes. But very hot summer.
Did you ever question, what am I doing here?
Quite a few times, yeah. A few kind of funny moments out there, like with people you'd meet or stories you'd hear about people from your friends. But there was quite an expat community out there. You'd be surprised.
And what, were you in a city or in a town or what?
Yeah, I was in pretty much the biggest city. The president at the time moved the capital to be in the centre. So I was basically in the old capital. But it was still quite small for the USSR.
Now, I'm sorry, my geography, I must have skipped a lesson, but what's the capital of, or what was the capital of Kazakhstan?
So when I was there, it was called Astana, but now it's called Nur-Sultan, which is the name of the president who recently stepped down. So he recently...
Okay, well, look, talking about the president, what's the politics like? Does everyone know the president? Is he their mate, or is he some sort of puppet imposed from outside?
Bit of both, really. I mean... Well, it only became a country in 91, so there's that fear of if he hadn't taken it over, it might be worse than it is now. But then the family do kind of own everything almost.
So this is with the collapse of the former Soviet Union?
Yeah, so this man Nazarbayev took it over, and then they own several of the top universities in the country, schools in the country. A lot of his friends or family members are like the mayors of places, and it's...
And who... in Kazakhstan wants to learn English? Why are people wanting to learn English?
I think Kazakhstan's actually, maybe percentage-wise, I've seen quite a few stats on RSF. They've got like, I think Kazakhstan has the highest percentage of people emigrating abroad in the world.
But you went there.
But yeah, some people like me decide to go there.
You bucked the trend. Yes. What was your sort of daily life like, you know, sort of from getting up to going to bed at night? What was your daily life cycle?
Yeah, it was pretty much wake up at whenever I wanted. My school started at about 12 or 1, so all morning I was, could do whatever I want. Taught for about 4 or 5 hours, and these kids were kind of like politicians' children or the local mayor's children.
How old were they?
So this is like a middle school, so kind of like fifth grade, so I'd say like 11 to 15.
Right.
So like pretty much some of the future leaders going into those classes and then finish early evening and then either... go out with some friends.
So you were teaching a sort of elite, a local elite, really, were you?
In a sense, yeah. I mean, it's a lot different now. When I first arrived, those Nazarbayev schools I mentioned earlier weren't quite there and ready yet. So I was in like a physics, mathematics school, but a lot of the elite children were there. And
a big country sandwiched between China and Russia. Who was the dominant of the superpowers there then?
Quite interesting, actually, because it started changing as I left. So when I first arrived, it was... predominantly like Russian speakers. So I went there and obviously I decided to learn Russian because of this. And over those first 2 years, they started moving towards more Kazakh and kind of national pride. We're not Russian, we're further moving towards Kazakh instead. But as I was my second time there, I was walking around and I did hear a lot of Chinese people speaking because obviously I'd been a year in China before that and I could understand and hear them. So it was moving very linguistically amazing. Everyone is bilingual. Everyone speaks Russian and Kazakh already, which is like Turkish and Russian, basically. So it's so much easier for them to learn languages, I think.
Did they have their own Kazakh language?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Which was that, nearer to Russian or Chinese?
Oh, it's like Turkish.
Oh, like Turkish. Okay.
Yeah.
Complicated. Anyway, so yeah. Did you eventually decide, I've had enough here in this kind of grey flat place and I need the city lights, as most young people do?
No, I mean, I actually did enjoy my life there, surprisingly. It was quite very old-fashioned. They reuse everything, they repair everything. It's that, like, natural food sources.
Have you got the creature comforts, like car, electricity, all this sort of thing?
Yeah, you did have electricity and that. You'd get power cuts every now and then. And felt the occasional, like, only mild, very mild earthquake there. But you had all the creature comforts. Cars were there, but it was like a flash thing still. So if you're into a car, you were top dog, basically, and you drive around like you were cool. But my buddy, who knew the culture a lot better, used to explain it that they couldn't really afford to go on holidays like we can. So where we'd go on holiday for a kind of a break or to enjoy ourselves or relax, they would kind of go for a little drive somewhere and... that was like their little escape.
Okay. What about after that? And you mentioned China. You've been to China. How did you find China?
a mixture of horrible but also easy. So my first job, it was the, for anyone that knows, China is quite infamous for bad working conditions, and it was exactly that.
When you say that, what do you mean? You know, your trade unionist hat on for a minute. And what sort of things did you find were, obnoxious about your bosses?
So they refused to listen to anything, and it was always about the profit. So money comes first over education, and that's why a lot of education companies now go out into China, because there's so much money to be made. It's like we had a conversation before this about British Council, and I think these examinations for students studying in England, America, Australia, that's their biggest market is in China, because they will spend as much money as possible on education.
But what about discussions with your bosses about, look, hang on a minute, why don't we do it this way? And they would say no. What sort of things were they refusing to listen to that you thought were actually, hang on, you know, this just is just common sense?
Well, things like getting the kids books or getting them any materials or anything like that. It was, they wouldn't do anything. But
Is that exercise books or something to write in?
So exercise books were the main ones for us. So before this, I was an examiner for what I was teaching, so I knew my subject very well. My boss, also from America, she was an expert in her field as well, and we did keep trying to change it and say, look, we need to do it this way. Or the study times, the kids were in school every day, about 7:15 till 12, and then 2:30 p.m. till 10 p.m. So some days I would finish at 10 p.m., walk home, go to sleep, wake up again at 7, and have to have them at first lesson 7:30 in the morning. So, I was very tired. I had no idea how the kids did that 6 days a week.
And so there was no listening to that at all in China?
Oh, no.
Was that the part of the culture?
A lot of it is, but then I think it's similar here to an extent, in that you do have to earn respect.
But I mean, we have this thing called the work ethic, don't we, supposedly, over in Britain? Well, it seems to have slipped a bit over the years. It sounds to me that's a little bit of an extreme version.
Yeah, no, it's insane.
Do they get much downtime, leisure time at all, these youngsters?
No, but then this is the interesting thing we'd speak about a lot, is kids in England do typically seem to have more antisocial behaviour issues in the UK, whereas in China they don't. But that is because the kids are in school all the time, and then they just get brain dead and have no energy to do anything. So it's the typical life out there, especially for a woman, was finish school, go to university, graduate with a husband, have children, stay at home.
I wonder if the education departments in the West are looking at this thinking, hey, this is the way to go.
They actually are.
Are they?
The British education system's now taken coursework off, and it's fully exam-based, much like China, and it's definitely put into this, like, your test knowledge over your ability to write essays over a period of time or conduct research.
So what was the upside of China then? You said, it's a bit of a double-edged sword.
It was annoying for me for my second time there, because I was pretty much running the show. I was designing a course, managing teachers on it and getting them involved in it, and hopefully getting these kids into American universities. So we did have one guy who was the perfect example of, he was white, he could get away with anything. So if you're white, you basically won't get fired. And one of the guys, before I set up this course, I was working there for a little bit. He was an alcoholic and quite frequently went to lessons drunk. And the thing that topped it off was he got drunk, and about 4 a.m., he went to the wrong floor of his accommodation, because most people, you live in the school. He's banging on the wrong door. So he woke up one of the other teachers, and they decided to promote him and move into a different city. So he actually got paid more money to move, because he was an alcoholic and caused these problems.
That sounds like a bit like the BBC in its days in the 1990s when I was there. People who started getting very low audience figures would be promoted so that they were taken off the air into an office job as a managerial job. So, yes. Okay, but what about, I mean, it must have been some sort of fun side to it. Well, you weren't working 7 days a week in China, were you?
No, I mean, again, the easy jobs there if you look for them. So I ended up returning because I needed an easy job, and I knew there were some there, and I had a few contacts. So I was in the cleanest province. So the first one I didn't mention earlier was actually the most polluted city in China at the time, just after the Beijing stuff you probably read about.
Which is which city?
So it was in Henan, the central province.
This is one to avoid, folks.
So even the kids got sick, and they grew up in that sort of polluted area. And you see the speed cameras offices, and it'd be grey. Like, they couldn't even see the roads from the cameras, because it was so grey and polluted, and Yeah.
So the camera is probably detecting a car, taking a picture, but what it's getting is a load of like mist.
Yep, you couldn't even see the car. So, second time round, I chose somewhere clean, and I think I did like 5 hours a week.
So how long were you in this dirty place then?
There for a whole year.
Well, how did you suffer any ill effects? Because, I mean, you do see these Chinese go around with a mask, so what happened to you?
Well, I mean, the masks, actually, as soon as they get wet, a lot of the chemicals can transfer through the moisture instead of just the air, so they don't last too long, unfortunately. But, I actually never knew I had a genetic hereditary problem with gallbladders. So I think one of my great-grandparents had to have it taken out because she suffered quite a lot of pain. So my time living there, I got really bad gallbladder problems, and that's why now, as when we met, I'm a bit of a health freak now. I've really got to keep fit. Can't drink beer anymore, can't really drink many fizzy drinks. It did stop me smoking, which was a positive. But
adding to the pollution.
Well, we thought it was more like a breath of fresh air, because at least there's a filter with a cigarette, we used to say.
Well, that's the sort of excuse you'd expect a smoker to give.
It was, yeah.
But anyway, so you when you went back, it was a much different environment.
Yeah, still similarly bad education and school. So this was a public school I was working for this time. But they kind of made like a little private sector where the kids who couldn't quite get the scores they needed for the normal school could pay extra money. And I think we had about 120 paying about 6,000 each. So if you do the math, that's a lot of money. And then we were all being paid maybe 10,000 to 12,000 a year. So four teachers, it was a massive money-making scheme. And they've made an absolute shed ton.
But it was a more pleasant environment.
It was, but I was also studying at the time. I mean, kids are always amazing to teach out there. And that's something we've all said is, whenever I ask someone who's been teaching in China, because this was my research, I wanted to see what people thought of China when they lived there, if they're not from there. And like almost everyone goes, well, the kids are great. And that's it. And you kind of have this understanding that it was a pretty horrible place to work, but the kids are absolutely incredible.
So what is it, do you think, that drives the difference between the Chinese culture and ours? Is it something I think we need to kind of understand? If the West is in many ways drifting towards the Chinese way of doing things, they're looking at the bottom line, the profit, and they're saying, well, hang on a minute, the Chinese are doing it this way. Yep. Unless we do it this way, we're going to go down, and the Chinese are going to actually be a more successful capitalist nation than the West is.
Well, it's really funny because it is the perfect capitalist place. Like, there's a huge divide between rich and poor. It is astounding. Like, you see people living... See, the issue is that the way that we portray it over here is we say that there are X amount of people living in poverty in China. But then the problem with that is that they kind of, in a sense, a lot of them do choose to stay to their traditional ways of living. So they don't want this heating or electric or anything like that. So technically they're
living a simpler life.
Yeah,
and you're saying that this is real poverty, but actually a lot of the things they're not having to pay for that people would associate with city life, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so it's quite... There's that double-edged sword to it. On one hand, they are quite poor, but then the other hand is they don't really want to conform to this capitalist approach. But the media is the big one out there because that's very restricted. And like even my friends have said, be careful posting that on social media when you're living in China. It's like,
were you able to stay in touch easily with people, your friends over here, and stay in touch with the Western world? Did you find you actually spent most of your time looking at stuff that was going on in the West rather than Chinese things?
I tried to take a mix because I tried to be kind of fair and give the benefit of the doubt. So I don't want to jump on this whole bandwagon like a lot of people do when they get out there. They just hate their lives and then they complain 24/7. So like we had a couple working with us like that and they were just all day, every day complaining, trying to...
You've got to make the best of it, for goodness sake, haven't you? Whatever situation you're in, otherwise you're just bringing everybody down. Did you actually learn Chinese? Learn any Chinese?
I learned a bit, actually. I learned a lot more than some of the other guys out there. So,
Did you pick it up verbally, or, was it...
Yeah, no, I couldn't write, no. verbally I was okay. I could order food, I could get around in taxis, and I was all right.
Counting to 10 is quite good. Especially, I always found getting youngsters to teach you is the best way, really, because they find it hilarious that you can't even count to 10.
Yeah.
You also went to other countries, didn't you? Kyrgyzstan?
Yep.
Where is that? And what is Kyrgyzstan?
So The city I lived in Kazakhstan, we were basically right on the south border next to Kyrgyzstan. So Kyrgyzstan, the capital there's Bishkek, and that was one of the big bases during the USSR. So Kazakhstan was kind of not much. Almaty was a small city, and then Bishkek was the big Soviet-made city, very grand, lots of statues, and yeah, great fun. But like that was kind of where a lot of the guys, if you were bored with Kazakhstan, you'd go down for the weekend to Kyrgyzstan and have a little party down there for a weekend.
What about Slovakia? Because you went, that's a little bit closer to home, isn't it?
Yeah, I actually absolutely loved Slovakia. They're much more forward than us with in terms of being green and not driving, cycling a lot more. And yeah, I was very surprised with Slovakia because I was obviously expecting from Kazakhstan, former Soviet Union, to Slovakia. I was like, okay, it'll be similar to Kazakhstan. But no, it was really cool, actually, Slovakia. Interesting place. But again, a lot of dodgy businesses out there, like hiring teachers and...
Well, we're talking about making money from education. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I think it's just a common sense that basic stuff like education, healthcare, that sort of thing needs to be done by the government. And, you know, without being too much of a socialist soapbox, mm-hmm. as soon as you leave it to the market, well, you tell me what happens.
No, it's just dodgy, disorganised. So we had, like, the company I worked for, it basically started because I think he got this girl pregnant. So because of his religion, he had to stay, marry her, and basically provide for her and her family. So he set up this business. It's partly UK, partly Slovakia. So it was like we were under the British contract to work in Slovakia, but then like you never got a P45 or tax records or anything that you were paying tax, but the correct tax percentage was always taken out. And it would be often paid late, so living paycheck to paycheck, quite literally. And some of the guys found that really difficult and did quit, unfortunately.
But, what about life in Slovakia then? Just generally different, very different, I'd imagine, to China, Kazakhstan or any of the rest of them.
Yeah, more similar to Kazakhstan because they like drinking in Slovakia as well. Like I think they're per capita like the large number one beer consumer in the world. I think they're quite, they used to quite proudly tell me, but absolutely lovely people. I absolutely loved it out there.
What about the military in Kyrgyzstan? Because obviously the Soviets have gone, haven't they?
Yeah.
I mean, that's it. Bye-bye, Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, as I was saying earlier, Kazakhstan does still have quite close ties to Russia. And there used to be a big American air base in Kyrgyzstan in Bishkek, which is where we used to go to party. And whilst I was living there, the air base were kind of basically kicked out. I think Russia put a lot of pressure on Kyrgyzstan to get rid of the Americans.
Well, no, the Russians are getting a bit fed up with Americans setting up bases around their borders.
So they left, and then we saw an influx of strange jobs and individuals coming in. So,
well, who? What sort of individuals?
So just before the airbase left, there was this one guy I worked with, and I'm actually kind of friends with him still, but there's definitely that thing in your head is he's got to be a spy because of the weirdest places he's been to. Like, I think he trained in Mongolia, worked in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, then I think he went to, Israel. I think he went to Palestine even at one point. Pakistan, he goes to like these weird
stuff. But what
South
was his, what was his job?
So he was like an examiner. So he worked for British Council, funnily enough.
Right, part of the Foreign Office, okay.
And then jumps around. He was all over the place. So every time I spoke to him, he was in a place I'd never heard of. But as soon as you do a bit of research, there's a lot of political problems going on. And
what about the Peace Corps?
Yeah, they were kicked out.
Isn't
of Kazakhstan.
That was a sort of American version of the British Council, something similar, or not?
So that was like a volunteer service overseas, we call it VSO here.
Oh, right, okay.
So one of my best friends, actually, still to this date, was Peace Corps, Kazakhstan. And, I was lucky, really, to work with him because he gave me lots of warnings. So, like, the first day he scared me a bit because he's like, if you're going to drink, it's fine. Like, you can get drunk, but just watch your drink. Try not to interfere with locals too much. If they get angry, just leave and walk away. Don't get in taxis too drunk, because when he was at Peace Corps, some of the volunteers got horrendously drunk, and then the locals would drive them out of the city, just beat them to near death, steal everything they had and leave them there. So quite a lot of people died, and then quite a few women were raped as well, so they had to be careful with that. And eventually, Kazakhstan, I don't know why, but kicked them all out. And he stuck around, and I mean, spoke fluent Russian, like, really interesting guy.
Any hint of Western military out there? Because they're not really supposed to be, are they? Most of these countries are now gone over to either Chinese domination or Russian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we did at one point, because we're in Almaty, which is quite a big city, relatively speaking. There was we did have a group of, I think, the Marines out there for a while, for maybe 3 or 4 weeks. And funny enough, we'd see them in the clubs getting very drunk. And they, I think they'd been sneaking out to go and party with the local people.
Oh, okay, because you get cabin fever, don't you, as a military person? You're posted somewhere, told to wait, weeks and weeks tot on, and you're starting to think, well, we've had enough of this.
Yeah, but it was interesting, because one of them was getting talking to me, because their biggest thing was they didn't want to get in fights and draw attention to themselves. They did often say, like, yeah, we're part of the Marines, but just keep it under your hat sort of thing. Don't try and spread it too much. But then, one of them was, like, mixed martial arts. I think he'd done quite a few of those. And he was telling me, like, he's really peaceful, he wouldn't want to fight. But if he did, he was had his background of mixed martial arts, and he was just a...
Yeah, don't mess with him.
Yeah, but it's nice to be with him if you're on a night out, because you're protected.
Yeah. So as countries like Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan mm-hmm. are going more towards Russia, mm-hmm. and there is this sort of new Cold War supposedly coming along, mm-hmm. has that affected your ability to travel backwards and forwards or not? Or is this all just something we're seeing in the press and it doesn't actually affect things on the ground?
It makes it a bit more difficult. So funny enough, when I lived in China, I'd go to Hong Kong. I love Hong Kong. Sad what's happening now, but yeah, I used to go to Hong Kong quite a lot. And every time we wanted to come back into mainland China, I was asked several questions about my living in Kazakhstan. And then my friend, who was funnily enough, he was married to a Kazakh woman, they would always stop him and he'd always have to go into the office and speak to the person in charge. And they were on the borders, they're under strict rules to anyone who's visited a country with Stan in, you have to pass them on to the boss and you have to go and speak to them for a while. So that was quite often. And
so what sort of questions were they asking you? You know, saying, are you a spy or what?
Pretty much they'd always say, what are you doing in Kazakhstan? So I'm a teacher. Like, you can see it on my visa for China, I'm a teacher. And they'd always ask a lot more questions. My friend got it a lot worse because I would just... Because it's a communist society, they get paid anyway. They don't really care. I would just pretend I didn't hear them and just walk off and they wouldn't stop me. But my friend, because he was married to someone Kazakh, he had a few more issues. But... going to Slovakia was weird because I got stopped. I think I went via Ireland and someone was waiting at the Irish border. This big guy, suit, tie, just stood there. So everyone's walking past him. And then a woman just kind of looks at my passport, just gives it to him. And he takes me to the side for a second and goes, what were you doing in Kazakhstan then? I was like, oh, I'm an English teacher. Like, I was working out there for 2.5 years, just, yeah, enjoying life and teaching. He's like, okay. He's like, are you going back there now? I was like, no, I'm going to Slovakia to teach now. He's like, oh, okay. You know, if you ever do go back to Kazakhstan, don't be surprised if someone like me does stop you on the border and we might ask you a few more questions for your help at some point. And then proceeded to stand there after I'd gone through, not checking anyone else.
So what do you put that down to?
Odd. Maybe someone around knows that I speak a bit of Russian, so it wouldn't take long for me to get fluent. And then they'd have someone inside Kazakhstan potentially. And because of my background, I'd go to a big top private school with the richest, most powerful people. I guess they
could be recruited. You could be recruited. What about the beard? Has that affected you? You've got quite a nice beard there.
Well, that ties in with Kazakhstan because of it's a Muslim country, although not really a Muslim country, I say. It's like we're like people, British people saying they're Christian. Yeah. They kind of say it, but not really massively on it. So, like, yeah, a lot of the Muslims will still drink out there. They'll still eat pork quite often. And yeah, it's actually quite nice out there, but yeah. Grown a beard, been to a couple of countries with Stan in. Yeah, even my family always wind me up about it as well.
You're one of the bearded ones, yeah, the suspicious ones.
No, it's
anyway, like Ed King, thanks very much for joining us.
Right, thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm David Saunders. I've been living in Bristol for about 10 years, and I'm kind of a bit of a green activist at the moment. I'm working on a solar energy project, but I'm interested in housing and health and food.
Now, sorry, you mentioned solar energy. I have to say something about these solar farms we see in the countryside. Are you an advocate of those? Because I find them actually quite, it's a bit controversial. What we had up until 2010 was solar panels appearing on people's roofs. Now it seems that they're fields, the sheep are being moved out or whoever, and solar panels are moving in.
It does rather look like that. The history of solar energy it's been going a long time. You know, we've had solar energy since the first satellites went up.
But fields of panels, this is post 2010, post coalition government, Tories and Lib Dems.
Yep. And the reason that you've got it in fields at the moment is that the economics of solar tilted towards solar farms. And the subsidies that people got for putting solar on their roofs for a while became even better if you were putting solar on solar farms. So we've got solar on close to 1 million houses in this country. Is that right? Yes, about 800,000, something like that. But since 2011, we've got about 11 or 12 gigawatts of solar. And most of that is in fields.
What about the energy used to produce these solar panels and potential mining or the minerals? Because we do tend to forget this, don't we, that when you're looking at something which is giving you free energy from the sun, there actually may be some kind of payback down the line somewhere.
Yeah.
You're also part of a much wider movement, which is this Extinction Rebellion, started in Stroud, allegedly, and round here, and there's had implications actually all over the world now. A lot of people are recognising it, jumping on the Bristol Stroud bandwagon. But anyway, how do you think it's compared to previous environmental campaigns?
Well, first of all, I'm not an official of XR, so this is purely personal reflections.
I don't know. Do they actually have officials? Because they don't. I mean, they seem to be very kind of flat. In other words, organisationally flat. So that means that everybody who turns up at a meeting is pretty much on a level with everyone else.
Yeah, that's certainly true. But there are people who work full time with XR. They have a organisational structure which they call a holocracy.
Some who are a bit less flat than others.
Yeah, it's kind of flat, and anybody can form a group. That's the point. It's super democratic. You can form a group. You can form an interest group. You can do an action as long as you subscribe to the principles, right?
So, but it certainly seems to be working. What do you make of them as, comparing them to other environmental groups you've seen?
Chalk and cheese. It's a complete shift. Things when I was a younger person, when I was young, environmental consciousness grew around things like Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring and the Club of Rome's report The Limits to Growth, which were influential, but nobody started battering down council doors or parliaments. Then you had the Rio Earth Summit as the science started to
come. So when was that?
The Rio Earth Summit, I think it was in 1984,
right?
And out of that grew the Agenda 21 movement. So every council had got an Agenda 21 officer thinking about the environment. And it was all very leisurely and comfortable. And then you had, you've all along had Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace. But then the next popular movement was a transition movement, which meant everybody who is into, something alternative, macrame or, supermarket plastic bags or whatever, had a place that they could meet. And it was great. And, different things, initiatives. You've got people growing food in Todmorden and everything. But again, it didn't change the world. And then suddenly, last year, a group of the COP summit said, we've only got 12 more years. It isn't 2050. Paris was, oh, we're going to get carbon neutral by 2050, which means not in my term of office. We've got 30 years, business as usual.
Yeah, so the present day politicians will be drawing their pensions by the time
exactly
the proverbial hits the fan.
But then you had the scientists coming up and saying, it's not 2050, we've got 12 more years. This is urgent. And something, I don't know the exact story, but like 100 scientists last year sometime decided that something had to be done. There was grassroots stuff going on as well. XR formed. And there was, I think, a protest outside the Houses of Parliament. People sat down in the street. They had an impromptu People's Assembly and decided whether they were going to get arrested or not. Some of them decided to get arrested. Some of them decided not to. And then a few weeks or months later in November, they were occupying five bridges in London. Then in the spring, they were occupying bridges and Parliament Square and Oxford Circus and Marble Arch. And then for the summer, five towns. So the public actions have been growing quite quickly and quite impressively. And they've now got a manual, you know, for called, well, this is not a drill. And it's kind of weird pink. It's not a little red book. It's a big pink one. But it's a manual for with a theory of change and the logic behind how just lobbying politicians to do stuff doesn't work. And look at what we've had in this country. For the last 2-3 years, as far as I can see, politics has been paralyzed. We've had a single issue country around Brexit. Nothing happens. Nobody can get anything on their agenda. Meanwhile, everything's falling apart. You know, hospitals, prisons, everything, housing, homelessness, refugees, lots and lots of big problems. And Extinction Rebellion formed a year ago and managed to grab the political agenda. And they actually said, you know, Parliament's got to tell the truth. Parliament's got to declare a climate emergency.
Well, it's just filling a vacuum, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I just found myself fascinated. A friend of mine had been up to London, so he was telling me his stories, and I thought, I'm just going to check this out.
Okay, so you've just been along to one of their meetings.
Yeah.
Apparently four, is that right, in Bristol every week?
There are four Extinction Rebellion meetings in Bristol every week. Yeah, Bristol Central, Bristol Western, well, I go to the central one, but south of Bristol, and there's like a couple of hundred people there.
Wow. Okay, so, and the mayor came along.
Yes.
Marvin Rees. And was he there for the whole meeting, or did he just dash in and out?
Yeah, he was there when I arrived. They start off with, so the meeting's from 6 till 9. The first hour they have food, which is great. I normally arrive a little bit late, so I get there just before 7 when the meeting proper is from 7 till 9, grab the last of the food and sit in the meeting. And Marvin was already there, and one of his aides or assistants, somebody else from the council, and he was there all the way through. And the meeting wasn't conspicuously different. He didn't speak. He was there to observe, see what was going on.
Okay, so what kind of things go on at one of these meetings, and what sort of, you know, what's on the agenda, what's being discussed? Is it all reasonably amicable? Are people shouting?
Well, so first of all, there's a shared meal, right? So everybody's eating food, which is great.
And it creates the right atmosphere, actually.
It creates the right atmosphere. And they have this, they have got sets of hand signals that they use to run meetings. So you're eating your meal, and all of a sudden you see the person you're talking to has got his hand in the air, and the room's going quiet. And so the meeting is called to order by somebody putting their hand in the air. 10 seconds later, the room's quiet, and the meeting starts. Whilst people are still clearing plates away, things like that. And they start with some announcements. This is what we're going to be doing this evening. This is a report back from last week. A few people stand up and say things. And then it's maybe a speaker. I was at one a while back where they had a really good talk about airports and air travel. And One meeting was a people's assembly where about a debrief and a report back of the summer rebellion. You know, so we met and discussed, debriefed how things had gone when they occupied Bristol Bridge and camped in Castle Park. So it's very fast feedback. And this week there were the meetings subdivided into three groups. One group looking at what's Extinction Rebellion's strategy going to be for the next year. Another group looking at actually the work of Joanna Macy, who is a great environmentalist, and this group were looking at her work. So it was the kind of training. It was a training session about the work of Joanna Macy. And there was another group, and I forget what they were even doing. And towards the end, and these groups are very well managed and facilitated, in my experience, and you get through a lot in a short space of time. They've got a lot of interesting group process work that they've brought in, and a whole section of them is called Regen, and it's about caring for each other and making sure that people are looked after. And they run their meetings and everything based on 10 principles, which are, you know, everybody is respected, we are nonviolent, and so on. So there are principles that people sign up to at an orientation. Oh, that's another one. How many people here are new for the first time? Lots of hands go up. Big roar of applause. Great that you've come. And they're shuffled off to another room to go through an orientation.
Does strike process. Me as a bit evangelical, is it? Sort of almost like a kind of religion.
Yeah, but these aren't the sort of people you would see showing up for a televangelist. Because, I mean, one of the principles, I mean, the one thing about evangelism to me is that very often you're being sold a story. And the first principle in the first demand of Extinction Rebellion is that politicians tell the truth. So there's a lot of people telling the truth at XR meetings. There is an emergency. We need to do stuff.
I mean, it's a complicated world we're in, though, isn't it? Because, you know, back in the 1960s and 70s, a lot of people were complaining about the, you know, rolling in of the motor car, the closing down of the railways, the arrival of plastic on the scene. Everyone, I think most of the people back in the 60s and 70s were saying, we don't like this, we don't want it, why are we having it? And it's taken, wow, gosh, 50 years for the penny to drop, in a way.
Yeah. And, you know, before that was really building up, the Limits to Growth report did this first. It was the first computer model of the global ecosystem. It's very primitive, but it did say, if you keep on doing what you're doing now, it's going to look pretty nasty in a few years. And now it does.
And that was an economic model, wasn't it? Limits to Growth? It was saying that if you're looking for economic growth, GDP, etc., there's only a certain distance it can go before the planet fails to deliver the raw materials or whatever, the people fail to deliver the labour force that you're looking for.
It was modelling economic processes as they were then. And the point is, it seemed that as you grew your industry, you were inevitably going to be growing waste. There are forms of economic growth you can do now where you grow individual wealth and community wealth. You don't extract profits and you reduce pollution and you reduce waste. So, you know.
God, economics is a black art, though, isn't it? I mean, if you can make people pay for the air that they breathe, then that is a big bonus on the GDP and it starts looking very good economically.
And but there are new forms of economics coming out at the moment. There's one that I like called Donut Economics by Kate Raworth, and that's has a lot about recycling. And there's a really brilliant man, Jeremy Rifkin, who talks about doing economics in a, you know, he's saying that this third industrial revolution that we're going through is different to the preceding two. And in any economic revolution, you have, he says, there are three things you bring in: technology for energy, technology for transport, and a technology for communication. And they all cost capital money and they all have running costs. So you, the first industrial revolution, technology for energy was coal, railways, and print, books and newspapers, next industrial, and they all had running costs, right? So you needed capital, and you need money to run them. Next one, you upgrade, and it was oil and electricity, and it was planes and cars, and it was radio, television, and telephones. And they needed capital to install, and there were running costs. Next industrial revolution, solar energy. Wait a minute. The panels, installing the panels, the capital cost is cheaper than the running cost of the old energy system. And once you paid off the capital cost, there's no running cost. Electric cars. Wait a minute. They're going to be cheaper than the existing cars that we've got. They don't pollute, and they're going to be running on dirt cheap solar energy. The internet, it runs on radio and phones. It uses the old technology, and it gives you communication that's virtually free. So you've created a society where the running costs are almost zero, and the capital, once it's paid off, you don't need it anymore. So you create a really efficient, waste-free future economy. There's a great free-to-watch movie called The Third Industrial Revolution with Jeremy Rifkin. I recommend that to anybody to really understand the shift that we're going through at the moment.
But with XR, we've even seen people chaining themselves to the Docklands Light Railway, public transport. But on a more serious note, there's a lot of people complaining about air travel. That is public transport. And surely the real shift we need to see is away from private motor cars to cheap and efficient public transport.
Sure. No question.
So why are Extinction Rebellion complaining about the very thing they want to see?
Well, I wouldn't exactly call aircraft public transport. Most airlines are not publicly owned. I mean, I would very much like to see.
Well, hang on. Taxis are public transport. They're not publicly owned. I mean, okay. Public transport isn't necessarily publicly owned.
Okay.
It's where the actual vehicle is used by anybody that wants to pay for a seat on it.
So what we are trying... So the first demand of Extinction Rebellion is tell the truth. The second is act now. The third is... declare a climate emergency and then solve it, right? The climate emergency is caused by the emissions that we have put in the atmosphere with our fossil fuels, and it's going to be solved by shifting away from fossil fuels. Now, you can run trains on electricity, you can run cars on electricity, can't run planes on electricity. So there's a lot of emissions in aircraft, and they're saying
Well, hang on a minute, because you know there's something completely insane about the cost of flying to, say, Aberdeen being one-fifth of the cost of going by train.
Yeah, I agree.
So there's something hardwired into the system at the moment, which is driving people onto aircraft.
Right.
Just for the profit, I should imagine, of the companies, the train operating companies.
So... once you start talking about climate change, you immediately get into details, and it's possible to, you know, pick a point and move that in a direction. And what we need to do is look at the whole picture, model the whole picture, and then rather than special interest groups say, well, what about me and what about me, and you're not going to stop me doing that, they're suggesting that we do, that we hold citizens' assemblies as a new form of democracy to figure out these knotty questions. It's like having a jury and bringing in expert witnesses.
I hate to say it, but this is what Gaddafi was used to do in Libya. They had these regional assemblies, which would feed into a parliamentary system, which he was a sort of benevolent dictator over the top of. So it sounds like we're taking a few ideas from Gaddafi in the Green Book
here. Well, there have been lots of innovations. I mean, if you look at Syria, they had a really good education system under a dictatorship. So any intelligent dictator is going to at least make his people comfortable, because if he doesn't, they're going to top him.
Isn't that the problem, that he might educate them so well that they realise he's a dictator and get rid of him?
Well, that and that seems to have happened. In this case, we're talking about deepening democracy, you know, deepening democracy and creating the shift from the problem with representative democracy, as George Washington explained it, was democracy as there's two wolves and a lamb, what's for dinner, right? And the wolves were the government and industry, right? And we're the lamb. He also said that freedom is a well-armed lamb contesting the result. And I think that Extinction Rebellion is the lambs getting themselves well-tooled up to discuss with government and industry what actually is for dinner.
But what lightsabers have Extinction Rebellion got?
Direct action and critical mass. They understand. First of all, having a meal at the start of the meeting is very enticing and lovely. Caring for each other is great. Forming a kind of community is terrific. Making it really participative is very appealing to groups. And as I said, they're moving extremely quickly.
Where are they going next? Where can we expect to spot them next?
Oh, I don't know. If you're sitting, there's a saying I heard recently, and it went, if the rate of change outside your organization is greater than the rate of change inside your organization, you're living on borrowed time. And I see Extinction Rebellion as really majoring on rate of change, and other organizations that are failing to deliver what people want, like government.
Or the high street, actually.
Or the high street, right, are going to have to change as a result of this, I think. It's a fantastic social experiment, and I'm thrilled that, you know, it's grabbed the microphone away from, you know, the Brexit non-debate.
David, how do people follow your work? Have you got a blog or anything like that?
No, you
sound like the sort of person that would be up for that sort of thing.
Yeah, I've sort of avoided it. In a way, I've been a researcher for the last 10 years. I'm looking for the actual answers. I've got ideas about what you can do for unsubsidized solar, how you could change the way we do our housing. None of the ideas are original. You know, I'm a fan of anybody with a great idea. Like, I love what George Clark is doing, saying, you know, we need a housing revolution. We've got to be building 100,000 really affordable homes a year. So, you know, I mean, housing rebellion, education rebellion, health rebellion, all of these things are possible. And I've just had the kind of privilege for the last 10 years of being able to research this stuff.
So were you on social media or anything like that?
No. I've stayed well away from it until there's no point in preaching to people. I worked quite closely with a social housing developer who ran Hamilton House in Stokes Croft, owned Hamilton House in Stokes Croft. And he was pathologically shy of publicity. He was only interested in what he called laying down markers, showing people what could be done. And he built some of Bristol's first eco homes. He tried a housing charity. He set up a anaerobic digester energy company. He ran lots of experiments while, unfortunately, providing emergency shelter accommodation to the council. And he was, you know, terrifically sad to see that homelessness doubled in the 10 years I was working with him. And he wanted, you know, eco-villages, affordable housing.
So you're not so much of a talker, you're a doer. But you've had a bit of a chat tonight.
Yeah, it's been great.
Thank you very much, David Saunders.
Thank you very much, Tony.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviews, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Ed King, teaching English as a foreign language in Kazakhstan and China, and also David Saunders, Bristol Green activist. Thanks also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time to stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. A field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street, singing songs and a carry inside. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. Into your life it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going now. Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going now. Stop. Now, what's that sound? Everybody look what's